From CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, this is UBC Arts on Air. We're your hosts, Brittany Dugan
and Rachel Sanders. On each program, we feature the ideas and stories of students, faculty, and staff within the Faculty of Arts at the University of British Columbia. This evening on the program, we sit down with Taylor Owen, Assistant Professor of Digital Media and Global Affairs. Taylor's current research and work is concerned with the intersection of digital technology and international relations. He recently published the book Disruptive Power, The Crisis of the State in the Digital Age. He's also a senior fellow at the Columbia Journalism School, and he's founder and editor of Open Canada, a Canadian online hub for international affairs.
He has an upcoming Canadian Media Innovation Workshop here at UBC on November 4th, so we took the opportunity to chat with him about the role of information in democratic societies. We're living in a really complex, quick-moving time with regards to your research interests, digital technology, journalism, public policy. What's of top interest of all these three things to you right now?
Well, in the journalism space, I think we're at this really unique time where we are witnessing a total transformation of an industry happening quickly and in many ways challenging and replacing the architecture of media that existed for 100 years. So just as a witness to that and a participant in it, it's remarkable to watch, right? I mean, we're seeing a total transformation of the entire field of journalism. And by a consequence of that is we're seeing a change in how people engage with media, how people consume media, how governments are held accountable, how the policy process has evolved, right? So all the things that stem off that the way that media system was structured are all changing as well. So my interest in that from the journalism side is like it's just pretty amazing to watch this shift happen and all the consequences of it spill out.
How has digital disruption, or how is it transforming democracy in our country right now?
It's a small question. I mean, so there's many ways into that, right? I mean, I believe that new technologies have enabled people and citizens to engage in their political system and in the public discourse in a way they were always excluded from, right? Used to be there was a world of gatekeepers in media to get your voice in the public space. You needed to either be approached by a journalist or have the stature to have an op-ed in the paper, and that was your way to the public. If you were a citizen, your only real way of engaging in the policy process was to vote, and that was essentially it. And now there's all sorts of ways in which people can engage in that public space of policy discourse. For governments, the only way they could engage with their citizens is to broadcast either themselves or through the media. And now all these things are kind of mixing together. And the people who controlled access to those to citizens and to populations are now have less authority than they used to have. And so in many ways it's a democratized space in some very real ways, but it's also really messy, and it's governed by a different set of variables determining who has a voice in that space and who has power in that space. And to me that's a really interesting kind of political question around if, for example, Facebook's algorithm is deciding what voices people see, that is now becoming a de facto gatekeeper. And I don't think we know how to hold those accountable, right? So it's great that anybody can post to Facebook, and that's a very democratizing phenomena. But at least when it was the newspaper deciding what voices were out, we knew who to hold accountable. We knew there was an editor at the top who was a person that we could hold accountable. You can't really do that with Facebook's algorithm. So yes, it's more democratizing, but it's also changing who has power and what has power and how we hold that accountable.
Facebook recently has changed what photos it deems to be culturally appropriate as to not censor after controversy there. Do you think that they're trying?
So they're trying to do something. Facebook has always insisted that it's a platform, not a publisher. And it makes that distinction for a very particular reason, even though it is, by any accounts, the biggest curator and editor of what gets seen in the digital space in the world, right? So if that's not a publisher, I don't know how else you would define it in the digital space. But they make that distinction because they don't want to be held accountable for individual editorial choices, right? So, and this is exactly the kind of case they were worried about, where something was caught by their algorithm and censored or deleted or not promoted, but is clearly newsworthy. So they do not want to be the person making that decision. But they've kind of been forced into it just because of the impact they've had on the space of journalism writ large. And I think they're starting to come to terms with this, right? That, okay, you can't both say to the New York Times, we're going to be your primary delivery mechanism for the content you produce, and also say you're not fundamentally making editorial decisions on how things reach that public, right? So it was always irreconcilable, but now it's just come to a head. And I'm not quite sure how they're going to get out of it. And part of the problem is that it's not a person making these decisions. It's an algorithm. And that algorithm is very ill-defined. They don't even know how it's making decisions. It's not like it's a thing that they can say, start allowing newsworthy stories into the feed. Like, that's not something you can really program in other than just by very discrete variables that they don't really know how will function. So it's this living thing that they can direct a little bit, but they can't really control. So they get really nervous with these kinds of decisions being forced on them.
Outside of Facebook, because algorithm is playing into other social media, what else should we be concerned about?
Well, as producers, consumers, and benefactors of the fact media is disseminated, right? There's kind of three roles we all play in that ecosystem. And I think the big challenge is a lack of transparency about how information is disseminated and who sees it. So a great example of this was around the Ferguson protests, right? Like, you probably heard the anecdote that the Ferguson protests didn't show up on Facebook for a couple of days in any meaningful way, because at the same time the Ice Bucket Challenge was happening. And for whatever reason, and we can kind of guess at some of the reasons, a campaign that made people happy and was really attractive to advertisers dominated the news feed over a campaign that clearly wasn't something people wanted to advertise around and didn't make people happy, right? Like, in broad terms, that was the kind of thing that happened. And that's constantly happening in our digital space. It happens on Twitter now that it's all run by an algorithm. It happens in all of our these new platforms that are increasingly becoming public spaces. They're the place where this information is exchanged, where citizens bump up against each other, where the state engages with citizens increasingly, right? And so if all of that is happening in a space that we don't really know where and how information is being exchanged, I think there's some problems there. There aren't easy solutions to it, because you can't just say, make them more transparent and we'll all look at the algorithm. And there's just reasons that won't happen. So we're in a real bind, I think.
Given all that, is there anything you are particularly hopeful or optimistic about when it comes to innovation in media?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think it's never been a more exciting time to be engaged, either as a person producing content broadly defined or journalism broadly defined, or as a citizen who wants to consume it, right? So if I, as a consumer of journalism, have never had access to more information about the world, high quality journalism of any kind from anywhere for free, right? Like, so I, as a citizen, am just empowered in some very real ways by the information I have access to. And that's an incredible thing. And something that often gets forgotten in the conversation about the decline of traditional media, which is very focused on the decline of an industry, and it often doesn't take into account the point of view of citizens, which is actually, it's really awesome to have access to all this information for free, all the time, in your pocket, right? Like, that's amazing. It just happens to be really bad for a newspaper that has to sell subscriptions, right? So there's a tension there. So I'm optimistic about that. I'm also optimistic about the reimagining of form that's happening in journalism. Journalism was a pretty conservative practice for a very long time. There was a way things were done. There was a structure to news. There were values that determined what was news and what wasn't news. And that was a very orthodox kind of view of the world. And it dominated because in order to reach large numbers of people, you needed to have a product that was palatable to large numbers of people. And that's the only way you could make the economics of news work. And that's now gone, that connection between objective, middle-of-the-road, orthodox journalism and the need to reach broad audiences is now gone. So it means that we can have a ton of experimentation in what journalism is, what different forms are, different niches. So you can get products and sites that just do very deep niche content that was never economically viable in the previous system. So to me, that's just this point of experimentation across these different spaces of journalism. It's really exciting. The challenge is we're not seeing a lot of it in Canada. And so that gets, I mean, that's a, there's a problem there. But I do think we are starting to see in broadly the journalism space some really inventive models emerging that are exciting.
Do you worry at all about fragmentation if there are so many niche innovative things happening that you might miss a bunch?
Yeah, I mean, that, there's no question that's a problem. I think there is an assumption that people consumed more of the broadcast media than they actually did, right? Just because something appeared in the newspaper doesn't mean that people saw it in the newspaper. I mean, maybe it appeared on the front page of a newspaper in the 1960s. Everybody who came in contact with that might have seen it, but they didn't read everything that was in every page of it, right? So there's a lot of mythologizing that happens about just how much broadcast or lack of fragmentation there was in the previous ecosystem. So they have to take that into account. But sure, I mean, on the flip side of that, so in the digital space, yes, you can get in these little filter bubbles where you're only seeing things your friend shared and all that kind of problem, for sure. But think how much more media one comes in contact now than they did before. I mean, anyone who's engaged in the digital space is just bombarded with content from across different spaces. And I don't think it's ideologically pure or only tailored to their niche. I mean, that is a problem, but I think we have to also take into account that just how much media people are exposed to now.
And I guess aggregators help there. There's various people that are doing that work, helping you see more.
Sure. I mean, and the big challenge of the digital space has always been filtering and how, as a consumer, one gets their information filtered. So a few years ago, that was predominantly aggregators, right? So a first generation of news aggregators and media aggregators provided that that window. Now that's predominantly Facebook, right? Because the vast majority of media in the Western world is consumed through Facebook. So they are now the aggregators. And that has its own problems and benefits. And that will change. I mean, that will evolve. I think it's a problem, but I think it often gets used as a little bit, it gets overstated how big a problem it is.
What about different modes of storytelling that in this new digital realm, like VR, you're working and leading a project on virtual reality for journalism. What's changing in the realm of VR? What's exciting for you?
Well, the excitement of virtual reality is that it very physically and physiologically can place a user an audience inside the context of an event. So instead of just an event being represented through text or audio or even 2D video, a consumer of that media actually thinks they're there. Their body's tricked into being there, which is both an opportunity in the sense that it's a very powerful tool, but it's also laden with all sorts of ethical problems and representational problems and journalistic problems, I think, that we're just starting to get a handle on. So I do think it's exciting, and there's some potential experimentation to happen there, but I also think both that where the technology is going and how society is going to adopt that technology is pretty problematic.
So you've been commissioned by the Government of Canada, you and a group of people, to study the state of journalism in Canada. What's your role and where are you at in that process?
So the government is really concerned about what's going to happen if a bunch of other media companies start really rapidly declining. So if Post Media as an organization, for example, goes bankrupt and several dozen news organizations in the country disappear, what should the government do about that? Right? If anything. And so there's a group led by Ed Greenspan, who's now the head of the Public Policy Forum, who was the editor of the Globe and Mail, have been asked to sort of explore this. Like, what should a government do if a media system is in rapid decline? And so through this process, we've been able to sort of engage with and study the state of journalism in Canada. And I mean, it is interesting in the sense that a lot of this innovation that's happened in the American market, and in many cases other markets, hasn't really happened in Canada. We have the CBC, we have a couple big broadcasters, we have a couple big paper chains, and that is essentially our media ecosystem. We don't have a really vibrant startup world experimenting in the media space. So part of what I'm trying to look at is why that's the case. So why don't we have a vibrant community of digital media in Canada? It's an interesting question because it ultimately connects in with our scale and our size, but also our policies. I mean, we have a very specific set of regulations and protectionist policies that have given us the media ecosystem we currently have. And I think we need to think pretty carefully about whether we want to change that or how we want to shift that or which types of actors we want to empower in that digital space.
And so this week, the Canadian Media Innovation Workshop will bring in just a lot more people to weigh in on that. How will the day go and what will the panels be addressing?
Yeah, so we're bringing people from that world, mostly from the kind of nascent digital startup journalism world in Canada, to look at why they can't scale financially, whether there's innovations in form emerging that we should be sort of building on, whether they can partner with legacy media organizations or not. So are they partners or are they competitors, right? Like, is this a zero-sum thing? What sorts of policies the government could enact or remove, in some cases, to help incentivize digital startups in Canada in the journalism space? And what the role of the CBC is in this as the sort of main dominant actor in the Canadian media space. So yeah, we're going to come cut out from a bunch of different angles. But the goal is to really prioritize the voices of the people trying to experiment in this space rather than the voices of the legacy actors who have a really prominent role in these discussions usually. There will be a public event for it at SFU downtown at 7 o'clock on Friday the 4th.
Thank you, Taylor Owen, for speaking with us today.
My pleasure.
That was Taylor Owen, Assistant Professor of Digital Media and Global Affairs at UBC. He's involved in organizing a Canadian Media Innovation Workshop on November 4th. The one-day event is going to be at the Liu Institute for Global Issues.
There's a variety of interesting panelists, including local media innovators Aaron Miller from Discourse Media and David Beers from the TAI. And then the day wraps up with an event downtown at Harbour Centre. It's a panel discussion, and that starts at 7 p.m.
To learn more or register your spot, you can visit mediainnovation.ca.
And if you missed some of that interview, you can visit our website at artsonair.com, where we'll be posting a podcast of the show. You can also follow us on Twitter at artsonair for ongoing updates about our guests and what's coming up next.
Listen to the wind. Our elders say it's bringing a message. It's bringing a change. Pay attention.
That's a scene from Konnalina by veteran filmmaker and UBC Arts alumni Nettie Wild. Konnalina means our land beautiful in the Tahltan language, which is where the documentary is set in northwestern BC. It travels through the small communities that make up the Golden Triangle to mining companies, Canada's Serengeti to hunting outfitters, and it's home to the Tahltans.
The film is currently screening at Van City Theatre. I saw it while it was at the Vancouver International Film Festival and was just blown away. I really loved it, and so I wanted to hear from the filmmaker herself. I went to Nettie's house to have her walk me through what it was like making a film in Northwest BC and hearing from all sides of a very complex issue up there right now. Hi, Nettie. Thank you so much for having me over this morning.
You're welcome.
Since the premiere of Konnalina at the Vancouver International Film Festival, there's been some controversy. What do you think about that?
Yeah, the controversy has come from the left. It's come from some people who feel that I haven't slammed the mining industry hard enough. and they feel that Conalina doesn't have a point of view. It does have a point of view. It took me 30 years to understand what point of view actually is. It's the point of view of the film is the pursuit of poetry in everybody in front of my lens. And the assumption there is that there is poetry in everybody. Keeping in mind that poetry can be really gnarly, that really good poetry, like any good storytelling, has tension in it and has conflict. And so if you're prepared to keep rolling and keep pushing into images that at first don't even make sense because they're completely out of the context of the way you live, we found that we got really surprised. I think that the vast majority of people who have spoken to me after the film and what we're hearing from the press are going to a really intriguing place, and they're saying, thanks for telling us not to think. And that doesn't say that they're not thinking. It means that they're on their own to kind of figure out a complexity that they haven't considered before. However, there are some people who are angry at me because I haven't slammed a very controversial industry. And the mining industry has a lot to atone for, right? But my objective is to get miners in the door to watch the film. And if they get a sense from what they hear and then later what they see in the film, that this film is not out to crucify them, but rather try and figure out their poetry, then the likelihood is good that they're going to A, come, and B, stick around for 96 minutes. And in that 96 minutes, they're going to be exposed to people who they don't agree with, who are framed in a way that perhaps they've never seen before. And the reverse is true. So the people who are traditionally in opposition to the diamond drillers and the linemen, perhaps are seeing things about those people in a way that they haven't before. And that kind of dull thud that you hear in the background is the sound of stereotypes crashing to the ground.
How do you begin those conversations? How do you get the subjects of your film to trust you and come along on this journey that is this artful filmmaking that you do?
It's really hard, because I can tell you that when you say to a mining executive or some full-on activist on a blockade, oh, don't worry, I'm just making art, it falls over, it goes over like a lead balloon, right? They just look at you with confusion and go, oh, yeah, we don't need you. We don't need it. We don't need art, right? It was a very hard conversation to start, because lots of people are afraid of the camera in these controversial times, or they want to use it as propaganda. So when they can't control that camera, which they can't in my particular case, it's very, very spooky for them. It's very, very hard to be vulnerable in front of the camera. This was the hardest film for Access that I've ever had, and I've covered armed revolutions in the Philippines and Chiapas, Mexico. It was really intriguing. In terms of on the, say, on the Taltan side, it took being there. And Oscar's mother was the first to really let me in. She's the woman, Mary, who talks about living in, she says, this is my living house. And she's a very, very in-the-moment person. And I think she just read my heart right. And she just trusted me from the get-go. There was no having to convince Mary. She just got a vibe and went, okay, I don't care that you're white and from away. You look kind of interesting. Listen, Conalina is just a movie. It's not a magic wand. But it's just an example of when you open up that space and you cut through rhetoric, then communication happens, and that has to be good. And there's lots of people, I gotta say, within the mining industry and the kind of higher-ups who are still not willing to be a part of that conversation. And same thing for really hardcore dogmatic folk on the left, right? So we've got a lot of work ahead of us.
So you're a triple major in theater, film, and creative writing from UBC. Uh-huh. How do those majors all now play into your work and career as a filmmaker?
Oh, it's actually, that's a really intriguing question for me, because I started out after I left UBC as an actress, and my work in theater and really having to plumb scripts and theater pieces for the elements of conflict, really having to understand what drives character, really having to understand what are the building blocks of conflict. So it really has fueled me to build that same structure into the shooting and then the edit of my documentary of real life people. And by that I mean it's really led me to a real curiosity of people on all sides of an issue. Because if you don't, if you follow your main character and you don't understand the motivations of that character and you don't understand the motivations of the people who are opposing that character, then you cannot build a universal story. You can't build something that resonates for an audience who perhaps is coming to that story for the first time. With Konnalina, which is my latest film, I've moved into a completely different type of storytelling where the main character is the land itself, this extraordinary wilderness in Northwest BC, which is in the middle of enormous change. And then the tough job for us as filmmakers was to go back to those first lessons of drama, is I had to put together an order to all these beads on a string that had conflict and tension and a beginning, middle, and end, and could hold people for 96 minutes as opposed to drift them off into some meditative sleep. And, you know, I hope I've succeeded. And there it is.
Thanks so much for having me here this morning, Etty.
You're welcome.
That was documentary filmmaker and UBC Arts alumni Nettie Wild. Her new film, Konnalina, is screening at Van City Theatre until November 10th and will be at the Rio on November 20th and 24th. You can visit konnalina.com, that's KONNELINE.com, for more information about Vancouver screenings, as well as that screening all around BC. So the website has locations and times posted there.
And again, if you missed any of that interview or our conversation with Taylor Owen earlier in the show, you can visit our website at artsonair.com, where we'll be posting a podcast of the show tomorrow.
Join us in 2 weeks when we'll be speaking with UBC anthropology professor Charles Menzies about his personal memoir and story exploring the history of the Kitkatla Nation.
And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send us an email at artsonair.info@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening.
Happy Halloween.
Be careful out there and see you next time.